Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are thrilled to welcome Dr. Michael Greger back to the show. Dr. Greger is an internationally recognized speaker on nutrition, food safety, and public health issues, as well as an author of several best-selling books, including How Not to Die, How Not to Age, and How Not to Diet. Dr. Michael Greger's work explores the crucial role that food plays in determining a variety of health outcomes, and he seeks to empower individuals to improve their health and prevent, treat, and even reverse chronic health conditions by eating a whole food, plant-based diet. Dr. Greger is founding member and fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine and founder of NutritionFacts.org, a science-based nonprofit organization that offers more than 2,000 videos on every aspect of healthy eating. Dr. Greger, welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us again on Your Call.
I'm so glad to be back, Ethan. Let's do this.
All right. Great. Great to have your energy on the show. And I should also begin just by stating that all of us at KALW, our thoughts and prayers and hearts are with those in Southern California who are battling these truly atrocious, terrifying fires down there. So I just wanted to say that at the outset. But Dr. Greger, let me start off by asking you about the basic components of a healthy diet. In your book, How Not to Die, you write that, I'm quoting, the best way to minimize your exposure to industrial toxins may be to eat as low as possible on the food chain, a plant-based diet. So Dr. Greger, what does a simple, clean diet look like in practice, and what are its benefits?
The quote you read is in reference to something called biomagnification, in which certain fat-soluble toxins, such as certain dioxins and PCBs and organochlorine pesticides like DDT, are stored in the fat of animals and accumulate up the food supply such that, we end up being kind of the polar bears or the eagles at the top and kind of accumulate all the toxins that all the animals that we ate then eat. There's this, I think, misconception that we only eat basically plants and herbivores, but we learned much different with the bovine spongiform encephalopathy situation, the mad cow disease epidemic, which taught us that in modern day agribusiness, we, you know, feed millions of pounds of these of meat and bone meal, kind of the slaughterhouse remains and waste back into animal feed, and thereby recycling not only potentially infectious agents like prions, but some of these toxic byproducts. But I mean, that's just, I think plays a very small role in our overall health. More important would be saturated fat, dietary cholesterol, trans fats, which raise our LDL cholesterol, so-called bad cholesterol, which is the primary driver of the number one killer, which is atherosclerotic heart disease for both men and women. And so that's really, I think, what's important to focus on, which means you're cutting down on meat, dairy, eggs, and junk food and centering your diets around whole plant foods. So you're minimizing processed foods, meat, dairy, sugar, eggs, salt, while maximizing fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes like beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils, nuts and seeds, mushrooms, herbs, and spices, basically real food that grows out of the ground. These are our healthiest choices.
And when you say minimize, I mean, would you suggest that people consider cutting out some of those foods altogether, the meat, dairy, the eggs, things like that? Or is there a sort of a healthier balance that people might be able to strike going forward?
You should try to eat primarily plants, but not necessarily exclusively plants. A plant-based diet is really more about just maximizing the intake of the healthiest foods, right? As a physician, labels like vegetarian or vegan, I mean, that just tells me what you don't eat. I mean, do you actually eat vegetables? And look, it doesn't matter what you eat on your birthdays, holidays, special occasions, but on a day-to-day basis, we really should try to center our diets around natural foods from fields, not factories, these unprocessed plant foods.
And what do you see as a primary benefit? I mean, what if people make this switch, assuming they're not already eating that way, what can you tell them that they're likely to experience as a benefit?
Well, based on studies of identical twins, only about 25% of the difference in lifespan between people is determined by genetics. So for what we can do over the majority of which we have some control, we can look to these blue zones, these areas of exceptional longevity around the world, where more than 100 dietary surveys have indeed confirmed that they all these longevity regions center their diets around whole plant foods, specifically using some form of legume, bean, split pea, chickpea, or lentil as their primary protein component. And so the longest, healthiest lived populations in the world all center their diets around these foods. And now we have randomized controlled trials which actually put different diets to the test and prove you can reverse the progression of our number one killer, heart disease. That's what Dr. Dean Ornish showed decades ago, reverse the progression of our number one killer by randomizing people to eat a diet centered around these whole plant foods. So we can help prevent, treat, and potentially even reverse some of our leading killers, such as heart disease, such as high blood pressure, obesity, type 2 diabetes. That's really some of the most exciting data. I mean, prevention isn't sexy. You know, when prevention works, nothing happens. But the fact that you can actually treat, potentially reverse many of these chronic killer diseases is some of the most exciting news coming out of the field these days.
It does sound incredibly promising. And I know there is a lot of research on this, but let's talk about just how bad is the average American diet? How far are we from this sort of ideal that you've described here about this whole food, plant-based, predominantly plant-based diet? How does our diet in America compare to some of the other countries in those blue zones that you talked about where people live longer on average lives?
The majority of the American diet is junk. About 57% of the American diet are these so-called ultra-processed foods, these kind of industrial concoctions of food-like substances that are very profitable, but unfortunately, they're kind of good for shelf life, not good for human life. And so most of the American diet isn't actually even kind of food. And so we are a long way. Only about 9% of the American diet is composed of these whole plant foods. And the rest is split between these ultra processed junk and these animal foods, which you really should try to cut down on. And particularly, let this be the new year, new you. Let's make a New Year's resolution to start trying to eat healthier in the new year.
And so you just talked about how bad the American diet is basically on average here. Can you talk about the health outcomes for Americans that might be reflected in this poor diet? In other words, how bad are we on our health outcomes where you could see improvement if we switched our diets collectively here?
800,000 heart attacks a year. That's what our diet has gotten us. Heart disease, number one killer of men and women. In fact, heart disease rapidly becoming number one killer the world over. And that's good news because there's something we can do about it. Again, the primary driver of our primary killer is LDL cholesterol. Everyone should know what their cholesterol is and try to reduce it as low as possible. And we can do that by cutting down on the three things in our diet that increase LDL cholesterol: saturated fat, found primarily in meat, dairy, and junk; trans fats, which have been excluded from the food supply, one of our great public health victories in terms of artificial, partially hydrogenated oil trans fats, still found, unfortunately, in meat and dairy; and then dietary cholesterol, found primarily in egg yolks. So by cutting down on those foods, we should be able to bring our LDL down to around 70, which is effective for primary prevention, trying to prevent ones from having their first heart attack. And those at particularly high risk, for example, those who've already had a heart attack, trying to prevent their second heart attack, really need to push that LDL even lower, between 30, 50, or really as low as possible, which is where the guidelines are now going. And so we can do that by not only cutting out the foods or minimizing the foods that raise our cholesterol, but then actively adding foods to our diet that pull cholesterol out of our body. It's the so-called portfolio diet, which came out of the University of Toronto, Dr. David Jenkins' lab, which uses a portfolio of different cholesterol-lowering foods, such as soy foods, such as beans, such as viscous fiber-containing foods, kind of slimy foods like oatmeal, okra, eggplant, added to one's diet. Different foods that pull cholesterol down, phytosterols, nuts and seeds. Through that, one should be able to reduce, he's been able to show, you can reduce cholesterol as well as first generation statin drugs. These drugs that are prescribed to lower cholesterol can do it without any side effects. In fact, only beneficial side effects just through diet alone. However, if you are unable to get your LDL sufficiently down, Particularly those at high risk may need to consider adding drugs to a healthy lifestyle.
And you've talked about how bad the diet is, with half of the calories consumed by adults in the U.S. coming from ultra-processed foods. How did we get to this place where these ultra-processed foods make up such a large part of the American diet?
Well, we have the tobacco industry to thank. Back in the 1980s, the tobacco industry picked up, became the largest food company in the world. They bought Kraft. So Philip Morris bought Kraft, and then R.J. Reynolds bought Nabisco. And so basically, that's where Kool-Aid comes from. That's where all these children's drinks, so-called drinks, come from, like Hawaiian Punch and stuff. They took the tobacco scientists and just switched and used the same, R&D research to, instead of, using nicotine as the addictive substance, well, we can use added sugars, we can use these, artificial colors and flavors, and we can make sure we can create something that you just cannot eat one. Indeed. So the flood of ultra-processed foods into the American food supply really was from these tobacco conglomerates, who used the kind of very, not just used the playbook, they were the tobacco industry. That has really, and that's where we see this rise of the obesity epidemic. I'm adding hundreds of extra calories to our daily average diet, which would completely account for the entire obesity epidemic now plaguing the Western world.
And Dr. Greger, is there something that should be done policy-wise, given what you just described about this sort of, corporate pushing of these really unhealthy foods? Is there something that listeners could get behind policy-wise to try to address the dynamic here?
I mean, absolutely. Now, in terms of policy that is actually possible, it really comes down to, I think, advertising, right? We got rid of tobacco advertising on TV. In fact, it's interesting how that happened. There is actually no ban on tobacco advertising. There was just a ruling passed that, for every minute of tobacco ad time, they had to pay to have like anti-tobacco, public health messaging against tobacco. And the tobacco industry realized that they had no chance up against the truth. So they kind of, quote unquote, voluntarily pulled tobacco advertising from the airwaves. Why are children being bombarded by tens of thousands of ads for, breakfast candy, right? For Day Glow marshmallows for breakfast, for, these sugary beverages. How about restrictions on advertising? Not taking away anybody's choice, but we're just preventing people from being bombarded all day, every day, by ads for junk food and fast food and candy, which is contributing to our epidemic of chronic disease.
Well, perhaps in addition to restricting, limiting advertising, as you just described, there's also the idea of warning labels. And on Friday of last week, U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy called for warning labels to be added to alcoholic beverages, similar to what we have on packs of cigarettes. And he cited the fact that alcohol is a leading cause of many preventable cancers. I'm curious your thoughts about warning labels as a maybe in addition to this restrictions that you talked about on advertising.
I encourage people to read the Surgeon General's report. It talks about this experiment that was done in South America, where they experimented with these very simple labels on alcoholic beverages that said, alcohol is a known carcinogen. Alcohol causes cancer. We already have warning labels in this country talking about pregnancy, talking about operating heavy machinery, but people are unaware. Most Americans surveyed are unaware that alcohol, even light alcohol consumption, meaning less than a drink per day, increases one's risk of cancer, which is the second leading killer in this country. And so there was an experiment actually done. It was so successful at reducing alcohol consumption that the alcohol industry decidedly ended that experiment. You can see a similar kind of tooth and nail reactions to, for example, the ultra-processed food industry against these front of label, traffic light system of nutrient profiling, where in Europe and elsewhere, there's been proposals, let us, because the people are so confused about nutrition, let us have the standardized labeling system where there'd be little, you know, red light, yellow light, green lights for saturated fat intake and sodium intake and added sugar intake. And you can get a sense of how effective these might be by the violence of the response, the vehemence of the response from the industry, which have absolutely crushed these diluted down any of these attempts to educate the public about what they're putting in their mouth, which really, you know, suggests that they're effective. I mean, we do have these, you know, you can do controlled trials where you have people, you know, doing these kind of supermarket video games, and you can change pricing, you can change labels and things, and you can get a sense that these are effective. But we actually have real world examples where they work so effectively that the industry put an end to it. And so that suggests to me that that would be an excellent way. Again, we're not taking away anyone's choice. We're just educating people about the predictable consequences of their actions. And then it's your body, your choice. Make up your own mind for you and your family.
Well, we're speaking with Dr. Michael Greger, an internationally recognized speaker on nutrition, food safety, public health issues. He is a founding member and fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine and also a founder of NutritionFacts.org. I'm Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and you're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco Bay Area. And we'd love to hear from you. We're going to open the phone lines to get your questions for Dr. Greger. Do you have a New Year's resolution to lose weight and need some advice, or do you have other general questions about diet and health for Dr. Greger? You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. We would love to have you join the conversation. Well, Dr. Greger, just to follow up on this last question around warning labels, the underlying issue that the Surgeon General was raising was alcohol and its impact. And you talked about it a little bit in your response, but I wanted to just dig a little bit deeper. It's a big issue, especially here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We've got a wine country that's an important economic engine. I'm just curious, you know, what is your recommendations around alcohol intake? How serious is the risk? Should people consider cutting it out completely? Are there different types of alcohol that might be safer than others, depending on how it's processed? So just curious, just to dig a little deeper on the alcohol question and health.
Absolutely. You know, everyone agrees that heavy drinking, drinking during pregnancy, and binge drinking, all bad ideas. But there's been historically controversy about so-called moderate drinking. Those, and this is based on the fact that those who tend to live the longest are not the abstainers who drink zero alcohol, but those who imbibe a few drinks a week. And unfortunately, what we're recognizing now is that this appears to be an artifact, a statistical artifact of what's called the sick quitter effect, arising from the systematic misclassification of former drinkers as if they were lifelong abstainers. It's the same reason studies can find higher mortality rates among those who quit smoking compared to those who continue to smoke. It's not that abstention led to poor health, but rather that poor health led to abstention. All right, so people who stop smoking, why are they stopping smoking? Because they got sick. Why people stop drinking? Because they get sick. And so then if you just look at those, you can see how current drinking would look better. If you go back and you just look at actual abstainers, people that actually don't drink, not former drinkers, you see that apparent protection at lower levels of drinking disappears, such that the World Health Organization, the World Heart Federation agree that the safest level of drinking is none. Grapes, barley, and potatoes best eaten in their non-distilled form, and Johnny Walker, no substitute for actual walking.
Huh. Well, that's really helpful. And it does seem like the evidence, you know, at least as we've heard it over the years, has been somewhat contradictory. Obviously, we've heard a lot, as you referenced, that you know, drinking a glass of wine is good for heart disease. And then even in these blue zones that you reference, where people live longer lives, alcohol intake at a moderate level appeared to be one of the factors for longevity, or at least one of the common factors across different cultures and groups that live long. So how do we square that information?
Well, the longest living population in history, the Seventh-day Adventist Blue Zone in Loma Linda, California, they aren't drinkers. And so out of all the Blue Zones, they've lived the longest. In fact, the only Blue Zone to survive to this day is right there in California. They're not daily drinkers. And so I think people can certainly live long, healthy lives in spite of bad habits. Like drinking, but particularly for cancer risk, we now know that even less than a standard drink a day, which is about 12 grams of alcohol, is enough to increase risk of cancers like breast cancer, which is the number one cancer killer of younger women.
Well, Dr. Greger, let's talk a bit more about what government, the role of government could be in terms of regulating foods and beverages. You talked about limiting advertising in some way of harmful foods, but what other kinds of roles or actions could government take to help improve our diet? Is there a role, for example, for our educational system to be more involved in shaping perspectives around food and dietary choices, or other steps that you'd like to see government take?
It's all about helping people make informed choices. In terms of the restriction of advertising, one thing I do want to mention, there's this really fantastic example. In 2019, Transport for London implemented advertising restrictions on high-fat, high-salt, high-sugar products. Transport for London, this is like all subways, buses, trains, and taxis in the city, reaching millions of people a day. And they decided they are going to stop. They're going to make a single change advertising policy. They're just going to restrict those high fat, high salt, high sugar products. And the looking retrospectively at the public health changes since, it's estimated that that change alone prevented nearly 100,000 cases of obesity in subsequent 3 years, prevented thousands of cases of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And so simple, non-invasive policy changes can have significant public health implications, and I'm hoping that the next administration will take that to heart, and we will be able to see some improvements, since we in the United States have the lowest life expectancy of the top dozen richest countries on the planet.
Yeah, are there any models, other countries that you would point to as doing this right?
Well, so there's an example. The problem with a more kind of quote-unquote heavy-handed approaches. Now, when we're talking about the deaths of thousands of people, I think it's worth exploring things like the tobacco taxing was very effective in reducing smoking rates, and there's similar. Kind of saturated fat or sodium or sugar taxes that have been introduced in other regions, which can help pay for some of the costs of the chronic disease costs that weigh down our country and taxpayers that have to deal with these chronic diseases. In terms of actually telling companies, look, we need to reduce levels of sugar, salt, saturated fat. What the UK did very effectively is they did this across the board reduction in salt and sugar. And the way that could be effective is that companies cannot, Coke doesn't want to decrease the sugar of their product because then they'll buy Pepsi, right? Because they'll be outcompeted by the sugarier drink, right? So only when you have a flat playing field, only when the government steps in or, some voluntary industry, group steps in and says, look, we're all going together, decrease the sugar of all our beverages. So then there no company can get this kind of competitive advantage. And the UK, first country ever really successfully to reduce national sodium intake, has tremendous benefits in terms of high blood pressure, one of the leading risk factors for death on planet Earth. They were able to do that by across the board. And so when you look, the same products sold here, the Cheetos sold in the UK have less salt than the Cheetos sold here. And you see similar things with sugary beverages. And so it was done at a pace in which, like, the population didn't even kind of recognize it. Look, if you want your food to be saltier or sweeter, and you add salt, you add sugar, you have total control, right? But it's just that the default should not be that unhealthy. And so by making these kind of societal-wide changes, you can actually see tremendous public health benefits. Unfortunately, I don't see the kind of political will to do something that broad-reaching here in this country.
Welcome back to Your Call. Apologies for technical difficulties. I was dealing with some internet connection challenges, but I want to let everyone know this is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are thrilled to welcome back Dr. Michael Greger to the show. He's an internationally recognized speaker on nutrition, food safety, and public health issues, as well as an author of several best-selling books, including How Not to Die, How Not to Age, and How Not to Diet. And we also want to hear from you. If you have questions about your diet and health, you can join the conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Dr. Greger, wanted to ask you about one of the big issues in the United States, which is the vast economic and racial disparities that exist here in this country. And the data consistently show that low-income Americans are significantly more likely to develop chronic health conditions and have shorter lifespans than their higher-income counterparts. So I'm wondering what role you see nutritional inequalities playing in perpetuating these disparities.
I'm so glad you bring that up. It turns out if you actually control for lifestyle factors, many of those disease disparities disappear. So, for example, African American men have significantly higher rates of prostate cancer than white men, for example. However, if you control for diet, control for smoking, control for other lifestyle factors, that racial disparity disappears. So that really takes the question to be like, okay, what can we do to facilitate to make it easier for people to make default healthier choices? And part of that is having access to healthy food, access to healthy, affordable food, you know, what we can do, again, from a policy perspective to help. One of the most exciting policy decisions in recent U.S. history was Mayor Adams in New York City got rid of processed meat from the massive public school system. So that's about 800,000 meals a day, removing, you know, bacon, ham, hot dogs, lunch meat. These are class one carcinogens considered by the World Health Organization to be known to cause cancer in human beings. In fact, colorectal cancer, which is the number one cancer killer among non-smokers. Why are we feeding this to our kids? We wouldn't smoke around our kids. Why do we send them to school with a bologna sandwich? Well, you know, in the very least, we can stop feeding junk to kids. And so why doesn't the federal government exercise more, you know, control over what they have control over? They're feeding people in schools, in prisons, in the military. And so, you know, in the very least, we can, you know, even if they might not have be able to you know, incentivize the private sector to make healthier changes, in the very least, you know, we can, you know, do better about, you know, what we feed people in veterans hospitals, for example.
And what do we do, particularly when we're talking about economic and racial disparities in this country, what do we do about these food deserts? The fact that many people or low-income, disadvantaged communities may not even have access to the kinds of nutritional food, the whole foods, the plant-based foods that you're talking about that makes up a healthy diet.
Some of these disadvantaged communities are being targeted not just by the tobacco industry, not just by the alcohol industry. If you look, for example, at the density of billboards for alcohol and tobacco in different neighborhoods, you can see that the same thing is happening with the ultra-processed food industry. These communities are being targeted with the worst food. And so part of it is educating people about how to make more healthful lifestyle choices. But then, of course, you have to have access to healthier food. Now, one doesn't need to have access to fresh produce necessarily. Frozen fruits and vegetables sometimes can even be more nutritious because they may be flash frozen the day they're picked and not being, you know, losing nutrition every day, you know, on a multi-week trip from New Zealand or something. No salt added canned beans, some of the healthiest foods are some of the cheapest, most affordable foods like cabbage and sweet potatoes and, you know, dried beans and peas. We have this sense that eating healthfully is more expensive when actually eating healthfully can actually save you a lot of money. So it's really, you can get the best of both worlds, healthier, cheaper, and you get to live longer.
Well, just want to remind listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Michael Greger on diet and health. He is the fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine and founder of NutritionFacts.org, science-based nonprofit that offers more than 2,000 videos on every aspect of healthy eating. And new videos and vlogs are uploaded every day. All the information is free. NutritionFacts.org is a non-commercial public service. No sponsors, ads, brand partnerships, or paid subscriptions. So definitely recommend listeners check that out. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. If you have questions, do call us. You can dial number at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. We do have one listener email question here. Dana from Berkeley writes in, I have an allergy to legumes and peanuts and would not otherwise be able to take advantage of some of this plant-based protein. What suggestions do you have for people like me? So, Dr. Greger, any thoughts for Dana on what Dana can do if you can't eat legumes, if you have an allergy, what do you do?
So legumes are botanically seeds, right? The legumes, right? A bean, you put it in the ground and a plant pops out. The same can be said about nuts, seeds, and whole grains. These are all technically seeds in that, you know, from kind of a botanical sense. And so have actually kind of similar nutrient profiles, having to have, you know, absolutely loaded with nutrients to be able to basically, you know, start off life for these plants. And so one would then just make sure you're getting, sufficient, you know, protein and minerals and vitamins, things that you'd normally be getting from the legumes, from, whole grain sources and nuts and seeds to get kind of a similar nutrient profile. And then exploring with your physician whether or not there are some legumes, since it's such a broad category, some people who are allergic to peanuts may not be necessarily allergic to lentils, for example, which would be an excellent substitute.
All right. Good advice there for Dana. Appreciate that question. Another question from Jan in San Francisco, who writes in about dry January. Jan says that Jan will be employing dry January, abstaining from alcohol and some fatty foods. And is this a good thing to do, or do you have any advice against this? And I guess I should also note that, you know, we're speaking just 1 week after New Year's, and many listeners, estimated 44% of Americans, have made New Year's resolutions, with a lot of those around improving public health. So I guess to Jan's question about dry January and these New Year's resolutions, what do you make of that approach? Is that better than nothing? I mean, obviously permanent changes probably would be preferable, but is this a good step for a lot of people like Jan?
Anything, any excuse we can have to start eating healthfully, to start forming newer habits, the better. To help secure our health goals, we can call upon our built-in cognitive capacity to create habits to kind of automate our actions. And this starts with what are called implementation intentions. So instead of these kind of vague self-promises to, you know, we're just going to do our best, eat healthier, implementation intentions are specific if-then plans to perform a particular behavior in a particular context. Like, you know, when situation X arises, I will perform response Y. So, you know, if I get hungry after dinner, I'm going to eat an apple or something like that. And so this triggering circumstance should be this regular daily occurrence. And that way these implementation intentions can become the beginning of a kind of beautiful habit. And so then there, we have good science, you know, where you randomize people to different kind of, you know, toothbrushing or flossing advice, or different to eat more fruits and vegetables. If I have no fruit at work, I'm going to buy an apple in the canteen at lunch. Or if I'm eating out, I'm going to order a salad. Or if I do this, then I'm going to do this. And that can start this long process of getting people to eat healthier versus just telling people to just eat more fruits and vegetables in kind of this just kind of broad, vague sense, where studies show people just will do it during the experiment, but you come back 2 years later and they're not actually eating more fruits and vegetables. Whereas those people who are randomized to a group that got these kind of instructions to form these implementation intentions, you know, think about the barriers to healthy eating, you know, what can they do about it? And then 2 years later, after the study ended, they're still eating more fruits and vegetables than when they started, and versus the control group that just got that vague information. So, you know, putting these kind of daily instructions, triggers into your life can lead to the long changes. And dry January becomes dry February and on down the list. And look, again, it doesn't matter what you eat in your birthdays, holidays, special occasions. It really is that kind of day-to-day stuff that builds up. So save that, you know, really rich dessert or whatever for some special occasion, you know, rather than, you know, eating it thoughtlessly on the couch where you look down and, oh, where'd the bag of chips go? You didn't even enjoy them. If you're going to eat a bag of chips, boy, you should savor that bag of chips because they are doing you harm. And so in the very least, you get a little pleasure out of it. Unfortunately, I think many people just kind of mindlessly do bad things for their health. Then it's kind of the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, I always think about the expression "just feeding the meter," right? Which is just bad food without really putting any thought into it, or at least enjoying it if you're going to do it. So I think point is well taken. Well, I wanted to get to the topic of just how people can assimilate all the information out there. It seems like there's just so much information that gets bombarded to people in terms of what might be nutritional, what might be healthy, fad diets, and I'm wondering what your advice might be for people. Just in terms of sorting through the enormous amount of data and recommendations that people get, and how really can people best determine what foods or dietary practices are best for them?
You know, it's not just the weight of information, the amount of information, but there is a very concerted effort by very powerful interests to distort the truth about foods. You know, the processed food industry is literally a $1 trillion industry, one of the most profitable industries on the planet. And it is in their interest to muddy the waters about, science around, added salt or sugar, trans fats, et cetera. And so it's beyond just, oh, there's lots of information, but there's the concerted effort to distort the information such that we cannot make informed decisions on purpose in hopes that we will just throw our hands up in the air and eat whatever crap's put in front of us. And so, you know, if there was any decision to be based on the best available balance of evidence, it should be what to feed ourselves and our families. The Global Burden of Disease study was the largest study of morbidity, mortality, disease, and death in human history, funded by the Gates Foundation, concluded that the number one cause of disability, for example, in this country, number of years of healthy life lost, is dietary choices. What we eat is one of the most powerful decisions we can make. And so if there is any decision to be based on evidence, it should be that. I mean, if you are just, you know, buying a toaster online or something, some random opinion of some stranger could actually be useful. You know, they write a little review, you're like, oh, okay. But when it comes to something as life and death important as what you're eating, then, you know, you can't just, you know, oh, some dude at the gym told me to eat this or whatever. We really should put a little thought into it because it is one of the most important decisions we make throughout our lives. And so that's actually why I started NutritionFacts.org back in medical school, because, you know, faced with simple questions from patients like, should I take a multivitamin or not? Well, you'd think that'd be an easy question to answer, but of course you go online and there's studies funded by, you know, multivitamin companies that claim benefits. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. And so there's just a tremendous, this surfeit of information that I really felt needed to And this is the kind of resource I wish I had when I was in medical training. And so wanted to make the most kind of comprehensive go-to source for kind of the best available balance of evidence in terms of just general information about what's the healthiest diet. I encourage people to check out the True Health Initiative. That's the truehealthinitiative.org. That was started by the head of Yale's Prevention Research Center, Dr. David Katz. He pulled together hundreds of the top nutrition scientists in the world to agree to a consensus statement as to what is the healthiest diet for human beings, kind of the UPCC of nutrition. You want to know what's happening with climate? You ask the climate scientists. You want to know what's happening with nutrition? Let's ask people who have studied this their entire lives. And spoiler alert, the healthiest diet for human beings is one centered around whole plant foods. And then if you want to get into the specifics, I would encourage people to check out my website, nutritionfacts.org, to see if your particular favorite food or supplement or whatever might be useful. I have a free app on iPhone and Android called Dr. Greger's Daily Dozen, which lists some of the healthiest of healthy foods. I encourage people to fit into their daily diet, like not just fruits and vegetables every day, but berries every day, the healthiest fruits, dark green leafy vegetables, the healthiest vegetables every day, tablespoon of ground flax seeds, quarter teaspoon of turmeric, the best beverages, how much exercise to get every day, et cetera, et cetera. Again, just trying to inspire people to make some of these healthier changes for their future.
Well, we'll try to have links to those on the website along with nutritionfacts.org that we've referenced as part of your founding organization. We are speaking with Dr. Michael Greger here on Your Call. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we're talking about the impact of diet on health, both individually and across society, public health. We would love to hear from you as well. We are getting close to the end of the show, but you can join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at yourcall@kalw.org. We do have a question from Brian in San Francisco, who writes, can you talk about the rise of weight loss medications like Ozempic and how they factor into this broader conversation around the role of diet and health outcomes? And of course, just to piggyback on Brian's question, we've seen a real rise in these GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic. And the data that we have is approximately 1 in 8 adults in the U.S. have used such a drug at some point. So Dr. Greger, what's your thoughts about drugs like Ozempic and diet?
I, in fact, published a book on Ozempic last year. And the kind of bottom line is that obesity so dramatically decreases one's lifespan, reducing life expectancy about 6 or 7 years, that like bariatric surgery, these drugs should be considered as a last resort for those unwilling or unable to treat the cause of their obesity, right? The problem is people who eat, you know, too much crap. Anything that can get people to eat less crap would be beneficial, but you don't need a $1,000 drug to decrap your diet. You don't need to get your, you know, gastrointestinal anatomy rearranged. You can treat the underlying cause with a fattening diet. I have a book that you can get at your local public library called How Not to Diet, talking about the healthiest way to lose weight. And if you're interested specifically about the pros and cons of these GLP-1 drugs, then I would refer people. I have videos on the website as well as a book people can listen to or read on the subject.
All right. We have Sharon in Marin County writes in, what are your thoughts about the prospect of RFK Jr. being Secretary of Health and Human Services? Any thoughts in response to the incoming Trump administration, what might be on tap in terms of diet and health?
You know, that's a fantastic question. And it's really hard to get a read. Right. And so one day, you know, RFK will be up talking about, you know, we need to institute, you know, this new California law nationwide to get rid of some of these, you know, carcinogenic food additives like red dye number 40. As of 2027 in California, foods will not be able to be sold with this carcinogenic dye, but yet the rest of the country will still be exposed. This is a food additive that was banned from cosmetics because it causes cancer, but still included in our food supply to make, you know, maraschino cherries red or whatever. And so that's wonderful that he would consider, you know, extending these nationwide. But then, you know, the next day you see him eating, you know, McDonald's on a jet, or he's talking about we should be frying things in beef tallow as opposed to vegetable oil or something. And so it's kind of this interesting hodgepodge, and it's like, what will actually win out? And you're facing some of the most powerful industries, the processed food industry, the agribusiness, and in the case of, you know, some of these like antibiotics fed to farm animals, you're facing the pharmaceutical industry as well. And even if he wanted to make the right choices, would he be able to in the position that he's in? We can certainly only hope and support any efforts to make healthier choices. And we'll really, unfortunately, just have to see if that's going to pan out. But, you know, I want to just leave people with some important points in that one need not make drastic changes. Mm-hmm. It's not all or nothing. Even basic common sense lifestyle factors can mean living a decade longer, not smoking, not being obese, regular exercise, more fruits and vegetables. And it's never too late. It's never too late to stop smoking, never too late to start moving more, to start eating healthier. We really do have the power. I don't want people to get lost in the weeds.
No, I really appreciate that because we are just about out of time. But I did want to ask, I mean, what would you recommend as the most powerful first step that someone can take towards achieving a better health outcome?
If there was just three things I'd add to someone's diet, just three things to remove, I would add berries, the healthiest fruits, greens, the healthiest vegetables, and legumes, beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils. If there was just three things I would remove from people's diet, it would be one, processed meat, bacon and hot dogs, lunch meat, sausage, again, increasing risk of colorectal cancer. Two, anything with trans fats. And number three, liquid candy, basically. Soda, sugar, sweetened beverages like sports drinks. Really, I want to pull those out of one's diet. And just doing those two things, I think, would go a long way. But the good news is we have tremendous power over our health, destiny, and longevity, and that the vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a healthy enough diet and lifestyle. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Michael Greger, author of several best-selling books, including How Not to Die, How Not to Age, and How Not to Diet. Just want to thank you so much for coming on Your Call and sharing all this really important and really life-saving information.
Happy to help anytime.
All right. Thank you so much. We'd love to have you back on. So to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes to give us a review. You can email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Nina Kissinger helped to produce today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, and it's Your Call.